as always, one of the important things of meditation is just to relax and be at ease and not to use too much willpower, right? And so this is one of the reasons we shouldn't be too fearful of things like sloth and torpor and these kinds of things. Because if we fear this kind of things and we think that it is bad to have to be tired or whatever, then of course we use willpower and we're trying to force ourselves out of these things. Then we can't really relax, right? We can't just really enjoy whatever is there. And this is one of the topics for the sutta we'll be having a look at afterwards. This idea of just enjoying and relaxing and being at ease is such an important part of that meditation path. So just relaxing, sitting back is a very important aspect. But again, also to really make the meditation take off, it is so important to find that joy and happiness in the meditation path. And as I was saying before, part of this is the silanusati, just the recollection of our own character and virtue and habits, and the good habits that we have. And just to be able to tap into that, because so many of us, pretty much everyone here, has lived a very good life, right? You wouldn't be here unless you were interested in living a good life. So you just have to somehow be able to relate to that, the things, the way you have been living it, in such a way that it actually gives rise to positive thought. You have to think about it, reflect on it in a way which actually makes it work for you. And part of that, as I said before, is just to sit back and just allow the mind to go back into the past to something nice and beautiful that we have done, right? And that can give rise to a sense of happiness which it may have done when we first did it. This is one way. Another way is to more deliberately use your mind to think about what it means to keep the five precepts, for example. What does that actually mean in terms of what we do for the people around us and for society around us? And one of the things the Buddha said is that when we keep the five precepts, what we are doing is that we're giving fearlessness, we're giving a sense of safety, we're giving a sense of psychological well-being to people around us, because they know they can trust us, they know they can feel at ease in our presence, right? And that sense of psychological well-being and ease is a very important part of having a life which is really worthwhile. If you always have to kind of be careful, always wondering what other people are going to do to us, you can never really relax properly. That can make life quite miserable. So we're giving a very important gift, a psychological well-being, to the people around us just by keeping the five precepts, right? And reflect on that. It's actually very beautiful. It's just like when you have a friend, somebody you know you can trust, right? You feel really relaxed and at ease in their presence. And it's exactly the same thing with us when we practice in this way. We're giving a big gift to the world around us. So remember that and allow that to give you a sense of feeling good about yourself, that you're doing this to people, to animals, to all of these beings out there who otherwise might be fearful in our presence. Remember, there was an economist who was invited at one of the first global conferences that was organized by the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore, and he gave a talk about economics, and he said that in economics, if everybody kept the five precepts, it would actually boost economic growth by several percentage points. And the reason was because it reduces the transaction cost in society, less lawyer fees and that kind of stuff, because you can rely on everybody, right? So it actually has a tangible, according to him, he was a professor in economics, tangible economic benefit. But much more important, it has a direct psychological benefit to all the people around us. And this, I think, is what is really important in this case. Okay, so let's give it a shot and see what happens. Okay, so as always, just try to follow a roughly the same outline for the meditation. Get into this nice habit where you're just relaxing and feeling good. As always, sometimes when a retreat advances, it can go through the stages more quickly, sometimes you can't. But just getting into the habit is great. So just start off, as always, making sure you are nice and comfortable, that you're feeling really at ease where you are. No pains in the body, and then also the comfort of the body, the relaxation of the body is so important at this point. the idea with this way of doing the meditation practice, assigning the ease in the body by just enjoying the here and now, is essentially to allow mindfulness to arise all by itself. When you feel at ease, when you feel good, mindfulness tends to arise because you're enjoying the present moment. And then when the mindfulness arises, it's good to learn to be the passive observer, the passenger on the journey, just sitting back, observing whatever is happening. And what you're doing by doing that is that you're taking the will out of the meditation, you're just allowing things to be. Just feel what it feels like to take the will out of the meditation practice. It's very peaceful. It's a beautiful thing when you can just be completely passive and allow the world to pass by at its own speed. See if you can get to that, and see if you can enjoy that particular aspect of the meditation. experience that beautiful freedom from burdens when you're doing your meditation practice, especially when you are far away from your ordinary life, all those burdens have been left behind. Now all you have to do, all the burdens gone now, all that is left is just you and the present moment. All the people, all the work, all the things that you ordinarily do, now it is put away, and it is far away, even as far away as Singapore. And you feel that sense of being free from all that, experience the beauty of that, and as you do so, it will empower your meditation practice. a little bit more power to meditation, a little bit more energy and happiness. Try to just realize how living a good life is a contribution to the world. We are adding something to the world, putting something positive into the world, building it up, helping people out, allowing people to relax and feel good. And what a wonderful thing that is, to be a contributor rather than somebody who pulls down. Just get off on that, enjoy that, don't think of it as an ego thing. Just feel it, feel the happiness of doing something good rather than doing something bad. before we come to the very end, just take stock of what has happened during the meditation, the last 45 minutes or so. If it is better, if it is worse, and try to understand the causality and the development that lies behind that.
Yes, I do recognize you. Where did I meet you before?
I told you to show me from Ajahn.
Ah, of course. Of course I know. Now I remember, yeah. I knew your face, so I could kind of connect you with it.
I just joined this program for you today.
Okay, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Originally, I tried to join more, but misunderstanding about the book people, but I just can't believe it.
Okay, wonderful.
I usually come, I think last year. Usually I go to Singapore
for
this year at certain time.
So we try to join this.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Okay. So, let's start again now. And this morning's, what is the topic for this morning again? I don't remember the name now. Cultivating inner Jesus. Okay. So, for this morning, I'm going to have a look at a couple of suttas again, which are all about meditation practice. And just to reinforce many of the things that I have been saying already. And these are some of my favorite suttas from the Pali Canon about meditation and how to develop it. Before I start talking about this particular sutta, first of all, we have been looking at the gradual training, we're coming to right effort, and now we're moving sort of into right meditation, if you like, which is Sammasati. Sammasamadhi is all about the meditation practice, Satipatthana, and Samadhi, and all these kind of things. Now, so this sutta is really about that aspect of the path. Now, one of the interesting things about the sutta is what? How do we choose? How do we decide which suttas are important, right? How do we know that a particular sutta is reliable, it is good, it is significant, it matters, and all these kind of things? It's easy for me to kind of give my opinion, but opinions are often very, I can often be biased. So it's good to have some objective criteria by which we can decide what is what are important suttas that describe the path. And one way of doing that is to take those suttas that occur again and again, right? You find them in all the different Nikayas, you find them across the different traditions, you find them in the Pali, you find Sanskrit versions, you find them in the Chinese canon, in the Agamas, so it's across everywhere. And the more prevalent something is, the more sure you know that the Buddha taught it in many different situations, to many different kinds of people, right? In different circumstances, it would have been something that he emphasized a lot. And then you know that that is an important part of those teachings. Sometimes you may find a sutta which you find maybe only in one place or something, then you can say, okay, it is not so important and not so crucial. But those core things are what really matters. And those core things are things like the Noble Eightfold Path, of course, the Four Noble Truths, right? What is called the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas. These are all the different factors that lead towards awakening, called the aids to awakening sometimes. And the gradual training that we have been looking at in some detail is another one very important of these ones, because you find it in so many different places. There's about 10 versions of the gradual training just in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings. There's another 12 versions of it in the Digha Nikaya. It also occurs in the Anguttara Nikaya as well. Right? It's a long sutta, but it occurred in so many places. Wow, that really makes it kind of special. Because there aren't that many really long suttas altogether, so it really kind of pulls it out, makes it into something very quite powerful impact when we see it again and again so often. And another one of these suttas is a sutta I'm going to have a look at today, which is sometimes called like dependent liberation, which shows you the progress of meditation practice from the beginning all the way to the end. But the difference between this sutta and the gradual training is that the gradual training focuses on what we are supposed to do, right? You are kind, you practice virtue, you have sense restraint, you have the full awareness. It focuses on basically on kind of our approach, what we have to do to get there. But this sutta has a different approach. It focuses on our experience. How do we experience the meditation, right? This is one of the geniuses, one of the factors that makes the Buddha such a genius, that it shows you the same process, the same thing from different angles. One is the angle of what we have to do, another angle is how we experience the path, right? This is kind of the beauty. The more different angles you have, you start to see the overall picture of what is going on, how this path actually works. So this is about the experience of the path. And you find this particular way of showing the experience of the Found, found it throughout the suttas. It's everywhere. It's a simple sequence of causality, how one thing leads to another according to causal sequence. Everything in Buddhism is about causality, right? There is a cause, there is an effect. This is how kind of the Buddhist teaching works very much. This follows from the idea of non-self. If there's no self, then everything is causality. So this is the sutta, and for this reason it is important, and for this reason it matters a lot, and it has a lot of significance. So let's have a look at this sutta now, and see what it says. And this sutta, you should have it in there somewhere, I think. Or maybe you don't, I'm sure, I can't remember now. Yes, I think you should have it. This is the Volition Sutta. And this sutta, I read it out every retreat I do. So sometimes people say, oh no, not that sutta again, I've read it so many times. But I don't know, I find it so inspiring, I can read it every time. I always enjoy reading the sutta, because it kind of drives home some very important points. So, this is how it goes. Monks, nuns, lay people, right? For a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no will need be exerted. Volition is just the will. Need be exerted. Let non-regret arise in me. It is natural that non-regret arises in one who is virtuous, one whose behavior is virtuous. For one without regret, no volition need be exerted. Let joy arise in me. It is natural that joy arises in one without regret. For one who is joyful, no will need be exerted. Let rapture, or even more joy, arise in me. It is natural that rapture arises in one who is joyful. For one with a rapturous mind, no volition need be exerted. Let my body become tranquil. It is natural that the body of one with a rapturous mind is tranquil. For one tranquil in body, no will need be exerted. Let me feel pleasure, happiness, even deeper kind of happiness. It is natural that one tranquil in body feels pleasure or happiness. For one feeling pleasure, no will need be exerted. Let my mind be stilled. It is natural that the mind of one feeling pleasure is stilled. For one who is stilled, no volition need be exerted. Let me know and see things according to reality. It is natural that one who is stilled knows and sees things as according to reality. So there you are. This is a sutta, which talks about, if you like, the psychology, your personal experience of the path. Ideally, right? This is ideally what it's supposed to experience. You don't always experience all these things, of course. But this is kind of gives you that map, that guide, how meditation ideally should be experienced when it really takes off. Now, once again, I'd just like to point out again that this sutta is something you find a lot in the Nikayas. Sometimes you find only small parts of it, right? Sometimes you may just see the connection between, for example, stillness and seeing things in according to reality, or you may find another four links, but you see it throughout the suttas in various versions and various times. Now, one other thing which I didn't say before is that this is also very similar to the seven factors of awakening, right? The Sati Sambhujanga. I don't know, many of you probably have heard of those, some of you may not, but the factors of awakening are those things that eventually lead you to breaking through, to awakening, to seeing things as they really are, to becoming arahant, right? So these are very similar to that, because the seven factors of awakening, they start off with mindfulness, and mindfulness is closely related to what is here called virtue and non-regret. Then from that comes investigation of dhammas, which is just another aspect of mindfulness, really. Then comes energy, which is close to, close to what is here called rapture. Then comes rapture, right, which is exactly what you have here. then comes tranquility, which is also exactly what you have here. Then comes samadhi, which is also what you have here. And then comes upekkha at the very end, which is like evenness of mind or equanimity. So the seven factors of awakening are very closely related to this as well. And those seven factors is one of the core aspects, one of the sets of the Bodhipakya Dhammas, the aids to awakening that I mentioned just before. These are core teachings of the Buddha, right? And absolutely core. Again, how do we know it's core? One of the reasons, because the Buddha himself said so. Before he passed away, he said, "This is the Dhamma that I have taught you. This is what you should remember. This is what you should chant together, recite together in the future, so the Dhamma may last for a long time into the future, for the benefit and happiness of all beings." What are those things? They are the 37 aids to awakening, which is the Eightfold Path, seven factors of awakening, five spiritual faculties, five spiritual powers, four satipatthanas, four efforts, and the four factors of supernormal power, or idipadas is the last one, which is a little bit more obscure. Alright? If you add all of those things together, you get 37. These together are known as the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, 37 aids to awakening. The Buddha said, "This is the core of my teaching. This is what you should kind of bring into the future." A very interesting statement there by the Buddha, and this is very closely related to that. So what we have then here is a map, right? This is a guide. This is ideally how each one of us should experience the meditation inside of us as a personal experience. Each of these factors leading you onward. Very useful to have a map, right? And you know whether you're on the right track or not. You have some idea what meditation should be felt like. So this is that map. Now, one of the things that you will see straight away when you see this map is the extraordinary emphasis on happy states of mind, right? It is just absolutely packed with happy states of mind. Meditation is not some kind of dry thing that you have to force yourself to do because it is good for you whether you like it or not, right? It is not like that. It is actually something which is supposed to bring joy and happiness all the way through. It's just so beautiful when you see this. I don't know, it's hard to avoid getting happy just by seeing all the happiness in there, right? You feel kind of elated. Whoa, this is for me. If you weren't a Buddhist before, surely after reading this you would say, "I'm becoming a Buddhist straight away because this is exactly what I want to do in life." Right? That's how it seems to me. Oh, yeah, if I'm not a Buddhist enough already, I'll become even more Buddhist now. So you start here, right? You have, first of all, non-regret. Well, non-regret, obviously, is a state of happiness. Regret is always painful to some extent. Then you have joy, right? Joy means a kind of a gladness inside of you. Like when you feel very light and kind of happy because you know that you're living a good life, right? You feel light, kind of jumping around a little bit. And then you have rapture, which is just another word for joy, really. So this is pavoja, piti, more happiness, right? From happiness, you get more happiness. I was telling you before, now on the Buddhist path, it is happiness that leads to happiness. Well, there you have it right there. Joy leads to more joy, right? And then when you have joy, you get tranquility in the body. You know what it's like. When sometimes in meditation, you start to feel really peaceful. The body feels really tranquil, right? The body feels so relaxed and so at ease. And sometimes it gets to the point where the body is so relaxed and so tranquil, you don't want to get up anymore. You feel like this rock, like you want to sit there forever. You just want to go do anything else. This is real tranquility when everything becomes very, very beautiful. Of course, it doesn't last forever because then you come out of the meditation again, but for a while it feels very, very stable and settled, and you don't want to get up. If people tell you to get up, no, I want to sit here. That's what it feels like. And then from that comes an even more profound happiness, right? Pleasure. From that comes the stillness, which is the samadhi. So it's just happiness upon happiness upon happiness. And what a wonderful teaching, what a wonderful spiritual thing, spiritual teaching it is to lead a life which is focused so much on those positive things that everybody in the world actually wants. And now from that, you can straight away gather why it is so important to find that middle path, right? Not to have too much pain in the body, but to feel relaxed, to feel at ease when you meditate. Because if you have too much pain in the body and you don't feel at ease, how are you going to experience happiness? There is no way. If you are going to torture, you can't torture yourself and experience happiness at the same time. These are contradictory things, right? This is why it is so important to relax and be at ease. And if that means that you fall asleep, so be it. That's fine. You know, you're welcome to fall asleep a little bit. But the most important thing is that you are at ease in your meditation. And now you can start to see how this fits in with this whole idea of a movement into happiness. So one of the other things that is important here, which is very doesn't perhaps come out so clearly in this translation, it says here, for each step, from going from one step to the next one, it says here, no volition need be exerted, right? First of all, the word volition is not very reader-friendly, because many people straight away say, volition, what is that? And it just means the will, right? The doer inside, that's what the volition is. So you should be making choices, doing things, willing things. And the Pali is the na chetanaya karaniya, chetana will, right? Karaniya, not to be done. So it doesn't actually say no volition need be exerted. What it really says is that this cannot be done by volition. It cannot be done by an act of will, right? So each of these factors is not to be done by willpower. So why is that? Because it is natural. When you have one, it naturally leads to the next one. Says it is natural that joy arises in one without regret, right? So if it is natural and no willpower is needed, it means you can just relax. You don't have to do anything. You can just sit back and just enjoy the ride, right? It is just so. Again, it's just such one of these beautiful things about the Buddhist path. You don't really have to do very much. In fact, the more you get out of the way, the more you allow the meditation to happen by itself, the easier it is. And it just tends to happen when you get out of the way. Not only does it tend to happen, but actually it is very pleasurable when you take the willpower out of things. You allow the willpower to die down. It is such a beautiful thing, because normally in life we're always pushing ourselves around, trying to work, trying to control things. For once in life, we're just allowing everything to be. Wow, what a relief. And I would encourage you to notice that in your meditation practice, that when you are able to just exist, just to be, without doing anything, right? When you're just aware of the present moment, just allowing things to flow, and you go with the flow, you have no opposition to that, you're not trying to achieve anything, nothing is right, nothing is wrong, no judgment. When you go along with the flow like that, that in itself is actually a great pleasure in your meditation practice. You start to understand why the will is not actually very pleasurable at all. It's kind of weird, because we identify so much with the will, right? I am the doer. I get out in the world. I organize things. I do stuff. I do business or whatever it is. We identify. So many people identify very strongly with the will. And yet, one of the things you realize is that the will actually is unpleasant. Far more pleasant when the will dies down and you are just aware and you're just kind of present, not doing anything at all. And this is the message of the sutta. If you want to have success, you actually have to allow the will to disappear. Right? You actually have to allow just to be with the present moment and not do anything. And one of the best ways of doing that is just to enjoy whatever you have already. Never look into the future. Never expect anything yet. It's pointless to expect stuff if you can't control it anyway, right? You can't control it, so it's absolutely pointless to expect it. And then, just enjoy what you have, and just go with the flow, enjoy the ride, and see what happens. And then there is the greatest chance you will actually have success. If you don't have success, then it's basically because you haven't put into place the basic factors here yet. Right? So this is how this works. So this is really. Really exciting, and of course you will also see straight away that it fits very well with how people like Ajahn Brahm take the meditation, right? Sometimes people get really frustrated that about, no, just sit back, don't do anything, but, you know, it's not happening, I'm going to do something, you know. No, let's relax. And that brings us to the next point here. Why is it then that the meditation doesn't work, right? What is the reason? Okay, this is supposed to happen, but for many people it's not happening, right? So why, how come it isn't happening if it's supposed to be a natural process? And the answer is very simple. The answer is actually right there in the text itself. And what matters then, if everything is a natural process, what matters is the very first factor, right? All the other factors, they follow each other as a matter of course. Well, if they do, it is the first factor that is the important one. And if you get that one right, then all the other ones will come, follow as a consequence. And the first factor here, surprise, surprise, is sila, right? We're talking so much about sila on this retreat, about how you purify your character, you purify your habits, you change your personality, all of these kind of things. And now you can see why I have been emphasizing that so much. Because that is basically the thing which allows everything else to take off. So maybe you feel a little bit despondent about that, because maybe you think that you are already a very good person, and you probably are already a very good person, right? But remember, goodness has many, many levels. So you can be good, but you can also be even better, right? And you can be even better than better. So the thing here is that we always need to kind of not so much look to the future, we always need to look, well, how can I do even better in my life? Is there anything I can actually improve on? And as you do that, as you look for those opportunities, you are fulfilling that first factor even more. Remember, again, here this is translated as virtuous person. I think that is slightly defective, perhaps, as a translation, because it is much more than just virtue. In English, the idea of virtue is you're basically not doing anything bad, right? That's the idea in English. But here, it actually has to do with your entire character, the development of your habits, what you are like as a person. What is your personality, right? Is it a good personality, or generally you think good things about people? Or is it a kind of average personality, or what is it? This is really the thing here. So it includes everything, right? Actions, speech, how you think about things, how you perceive the world around you. It includes both the negative and positive, not just the avoiding the bad, but doing the good. And when you put all that together, it kind of approximates to what we would call character in English, because it has to do with your entire being, what you are like as a person. So virtuous doesn't really give the full breadth here, the full scope of what is meant by the Pali word sila. And once you understand the scope, the breadth of this word sila, you start to see why, actually, it is very demanding to fulfill it completely. Okay, keeping the five precepts, most people can do that if they're committed to Buddhism. Actually, the truth is, the vast majority of Buddhists never keep the five precepts, right? this is an unfortunate reality. But so you're actually already doing really well if you keep the five precepts. I should add that, otherwise you might feel bad about things. So it's not very useful. But if you are really committed to the path, take it one level higher, right? Don't be satisfied with the five precepts. Here you can see, actually, we need to up the game even more and see how far we can take this. The more purified you are, the more easy, the more natural this process is going to be for you. So look into that. So that is about the virtue, and then the rest happens automatically, right? So the other end of the path is also quite interesting, because that is kind of, it's not actually the end, it actually goes even further. This is just an extract from the sutta. It goes all the way to final liberation, which is like arahatship. But I thought that usually you don't actually have to look all the way to the end, because if you come to a certain point, things start to become very automatic. This is far enough, but interesting to look at this other end as well. And it says here that you want to get to this point of knowing and seeing things according to reality, right? It says here, as they really are, I prefer according to reality, because as they really are, it seems like something is actually solid, when really things are always changing. It's just seeing things according to reality is, I think, a better translation. It's a very refined point, but sometimes these refined points matter as well. That's what we want to do, right? if you're going to be wise, you have to understand things according to reality. If you are blind about how the world works, how are you going to make good decisions about things? If you don't see things in the right way, you're going to make very poor decisions, right? It is very obvious that is the case. Any decision you make in life is always based on the best possible information. Right? If you're going to go down to the shop and buy something, if you think the shop is to the left when it is to the right, you're going to be very frustrated. Everything we do in life has to be based on accurate information. And it's exactly the same thing on the spiritual path. If you are deluded about reality, you're going to make very bad decisions in life. So this is the beautiful thing about Buddhism. We want to face up to reality. May not always be pleasant, may not always be easy, but in the end, it's going to help us to make good decisions and therefore be more happy as people. It just makes sense, right? Delusion is never going to be helpful if you want to be happy or avoid suffering. Now, the interesting point in the sutta is, of course, that it says the cause, right? The thing which gives rise to this seeing things according to reality is what? It's stillness. It's samadhi. Samadhi is what actually gives rise to these things. It is such an extraordinarily important point in the suttas. Remember I said this is a core sutta, right? This structure of these factors is found so many different places. It is found, this sutta exists in Chinese translation as well. It was translated into Chinese about year 400 or something like that, so it's really old style Chinese. I don't know, for those of you who might read modern Chinese, you might not be able to read this stuff because it's very quite different from modern Chinese. And that again, that Chinese translation came from what is known as the Samastivadin school. Am I right about that? Yeah, the Samastivadin school of Buddhism, which separated from the Theravadin school of Buddhism around the time of Ashoka. Around 300 BC, right? Or just after 300 BC. Really, really long time ago, since these things parted in different ways. And then you can now read, now the Chinese translation has in turn been translated into English, and I happen to have a copy of that in my little hut in the forest. My hut in the forest has all kind of this kind of stuff in it, and so it looks a little bit like a small library in there, which is sometimes a bit... Well, so when you look at these suttas, right, that have been separated for 2,300 years, and you compare them, they are virtually exactly, word for word, the same. That is what is so astonishing about this. I'm just saying that to make it clear that these are core teachings that go back to the very beginning of Buddhism, and there's every reason to think that the Buddha spoke exactly these things. So samadhi is the cause for seeing things according to reality, right? So important. And people often forget that. And there's too many Buddhist teachings taught where this is actually not really emphasized enough, not really understood enough. I'm not saying that vipassana is bad or anything like that. Vipassana also has its place on the Buddhist path, of course. But all I'm saying is that at some point on this path, you have to pass through samadhi. If you don't get to samadhi, you're not going to see things according to reality. It's as simple as that. So we have to bring in the samatha, the calm aspect. We have to bring in the vipassana aspect, the clear seeing. And when all of those come together in the right way, they lead to samadhi, and then you see things according to reality. Right? So remember that. When you know the suttas, you can see these things for yourself, and then it becomes clear how important these things are. So these are the two end points of the sutta, right? Begins with virtue, and then it all happens naturally all the way to seeing things as they actually are. Now, let us just have a quick look at all of these factors and see how it actually works, how this path actually works. So you have some idea what to kind of look forward to in your life. Maybe you have it already, but if you haven't got it already, what you have to look forward to if you practice in the right way. So you start off by doing all the right things, and of course the consequence of that is that you have no regret, right? And no regret here is a very broad word. It doesn't just mean, oh no, I shouldn't have done that. It doesn't just mean that. It means that when you sometimes if you do something which isn't quite right, what that feels like, it feels like it takes a bit of the energy out of your mind, it takes a bit of the happiness, takes a bit of the brightness out of your mind. You get a little bit more dull, a little bit more dark, right? That is part of what is meant by regret, as you are depleting your mind of all of these good qualities that otherwise would be there. So I, again, this is one of those things I would really recommend you to look at in your ordinary life. See how your conduct has a direct impact on your mind, right? What happens when you do something which isn't quite right? What happens by contrast when you do something which is really kind? Remember I was talking earlier on the retreat about this idea of karma in this very life? And that is basically what you're seeing there. You can see the direct effect on your mind of your actions, of your thinking, of everything right here, right now. So stand back, don't judge yourself, don't say this is bad, just stand back and feel and see what's happening, right? This is much more powerful than judging yourself. Okay, I made a mistake. Don't block that out, don't suppress it, don't try to control it, don't try to overcome it right away. Just accept that you did a mistake. Everybody makes mistakes. It's perfectly okay to make a mistake, so that's okay. Okay, what does it feel like? What is the consequence of this, right? And when you are non-judgmental towards yourself, you don't kind of try to fix things up straight away, and you just watch the consequences. When you see the consequences, that becomes the most powerful persuasive tool to understand why you should not do it in the future. You are destroying your own life. That's what you're basically saying. You're destroying your own happiness. You're destroying the very sense of feeling good as a human being. And you can see that directly in your own mind as a consequence of that observation. But you have to stand back, right, and just observe and not be involved. Once you get involved, you're going to destroy some of your ability to see things clearly. Okay, I made a mistake. This is what it feels like. I did something kind. This is what it feels like, right? And then you get some understanding of what is going on. And this is really the broader sense of non-regret here. Avipatthisara is the Pali word, and basically means non-regret. And of course then, as that non-regret, right, the darkness of the mind, the cloudiness of the mind, the lack of sharpness, and that dies away and the opposite qualities start to arise, then of course you get the next factor, you get pamuja, you start to feel glad, right? It says joy here, but gladness is a perfectly acceptable translation. Pamuja is the Pali word. And now we're moving into the realm of happiness. Right? So here now you can imagine you are meditating already, you're sitting down, closing your eyes, and because you've been living a good life, sometimes you feel happiness inside. Sometimes we don't. Remember, these things are uncertain, right? All kinds of factors come into this. You're not going to feel happiness every time you sit down. That is demanding way too much of a meditation practice. But sometimes you will feel that gladness arising. And then, as you continue practicing, let's say that you're watching the breath, I should also have mentioned this, that what we are really doing here is things like breath meditation, right? All of these things happen when you're doing breath meditation or satipatthana or that kind of stuff. This is where these things happen. So you're watching the breath, the gladness is there. Then you just keep on watching the breath, right? No involvement, allowing your breath to be. Your breath is your best friend in the world on this path of meditation practice. Moving towards samadhi, because your breath is your friend. You don't control your friend. You allow your friend to be. You're just walking together in this beautiful way. We have all these right perceptions about things, and then the happiness becomes more profound, right? And it moves on to what is here called piti, which can be very kind of powerful physical sensation in the body of pleasure. Powerful pleasure, but it's a good pleasure. It's not a pleasure that has anything to do with sensuality. It's a pleasure which is called the Niramisa Sukha in Pali, the pleasure which is like non-carnal, is sometimes the translation, right? Carnal is like not to do with the physical body, basically. That's what it means. So, piti. And then, as you continue on that path, the piti, this powerful sense of pleasure in the body, starts to die down. Because the body becomes tranquil. And when the body becomes tranquil, it fades away, and you can no longer feel these physical feelings at all. They start to fade into the background. You become very peaceful. You become like this solid rock, right? And you just want to sit there forever and ever and ever, because everything is so delightful. And from that comes this even more profound delight, which is the happiness, the sukha here in the meditation practice. Right? A very profound, deep sense of happiness. A kind of happiness you have never experienced perhaps in your entire life before. You think, wow, this Buddhism is really good stuff, right? This is what I want to do with this life, all future lives, all past lives, everything, this is it. You're starting to come into contact with the meaning of life itself at this point. And because you are, because it's so beautiful and so wonderful, you cannot help that the mind becomes still, because you're focusing 100% on what is going on. The breath is beautiful. Everything is just so beautiful and so wonderful. You cannot help but starting to move towards samadhi at this particular stage. And this draws you in, pulls you in, and samadhi happens as a consequence. Right? That is the theory anyway. And then you just have to kind of keep on at the basics, and then that happens. And then when you have the samadhi, because the mind is then empowered, all the defilements are gone, all of these distorting things in the mind which distort our ability to see reality, that's what defilements are, they are gone. That's when you can actually see things according to reality. That's how this path works, right? Very beautiful, very powerful. So there you have everything you really need to know how to get going on that path. Now what you need, and this is the hardest thing of all, and this is what I'm actually going to give a talk on this in Singapore tomorrow, is the hardest thing of all, the Buddha, is actually just to commit yourself to this and persevere in it. That is the hardest part. You have the information you need, you just got to commit. Because commitment means a degree of confidence, it means a degree of faith, it means a degree of not allowing yourself to be too sidetracked in daily life. It can be very hard, right, in daily life to keep your focus on these things. So that is why that is the hardest part of the Buddhist path. But there you are, you have all the information you need, and now just put it into practice. So what I would like to do now is to show a little bit more how this works. And that is the next sutta here called the Mahanama Sutta. And it shows you how that movement from being virtuous, having a good character, having good habits, how that actually transforms into meditation. It gives a bit more detail on that. So again, it shows you how important this is, right? There's so many suttas on this particular subject and topic. So let me read this out to you, and then I will comment on it in this afterwards as usual. Again, Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects his own virtuous behavior as unbroken, flawless, unblemished, unblotched, freeing, praised by the wise, ungrasped, leading to stillness, samadhi. But a noble disciple recollects his good character on that occasion. His mind is not obsessed by greed, by anger, and by delusion, or by confusion. On that occasion, his mind is simply straight, based on a good character. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the goal, gains inspiration in the teaching, gains joy connected with the teaching. When he is joyful, rapture, piti arises. For one with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. Right? You've seen this before, perhaps. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, the mind becomes stilled. This is called a noble disciple who dwells in balance amid an unbalanced population, who dwells without suffering or unafflicted amid a suffering population. As one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of virtuous behavior or of his good character. So straight away, you know, I mean, I was telling you that this sequence occurs many places in the suttas, right? There it is, right away. You can see exactly the same sequence we saw before. You gain the joy, then the rapture, then the tranquility, then the... It's not exactly the same because it's missing the first, it's missing kind of non-regret really, and it's missing the last one, seeing, knowing and seeing things as they actually are. You can see there are slight variations on the same thing, but obviously it's basically the same thing that you are seeing there. So here, this shows you how the seal understanding, right? Seal understanding, how it actually works, how the recollection of your character actually works out. This is what this is about. So here we have Mahanama. Mahanama is a cousin of the Buddha. And this particular sutta concerns the noble disciple, the Aryasavaka. And of course, the noble people, the Aryas, they are the ones who have, for them it is the most easy to do this kind of recollection, because for them the virtuous behavior and the character, all that is quite automatic, right? But we are trying to approximate to that. And because we are trying to approximate to that, we also can find a similar kind of inspiration in this. Not as easy as the noble one, the Aryas, but still we can do the same kind of thing here. So this is how you recollect this behavior, right? Unbroken, flawless, unblemished, unblotched. So all of this shows you the strength that is required of that virtuous behavior. The more pure it is, the more powerful it is going to be. That's basically what that is saying. Right? It is freeing. I think this is one of those really important little things on the Buddhist path, to understand that being virtuous, living a good life, actually is liberating. People sometimes think, oh, I don't want to be kind of bound by all these rules and all this kind of stuff. I want to be free, right? That's what people think. You're not free at all. You're being run around by the defilements of the mind. They are in charge. I don't know if you remember the sutta we read before, the Ratapala Sutta, the four summaries of the Dhamma. One of them, you are a slave to craving, right? If you are a slave, are you free? Are slaves free? Well, that's precisely what a slave is not, right? This is the kind of the meaning of a slave, that you are not free yet. So we are slaves to our defilements. We are slaves to these things. So when we go counter to these and we reduce the defilements, actually, that is a freeing experience. It is a freeing of the mind. And it's one of those things, you'll hear Ajahn Brahma was talking about that. He talks about the difference between the freedom of desire compared to the freedom from desire. Exactly the same thing. The freedom of desire is actually not freedom at all. It is just being a slave to craving. But the freedom from desire, that is the real freedom. You actually feel a real sense of liberation psychologically. Right? And that is what real freedom is. And this starts off with living the life well in this way. Already at that point, you will experience a lot of that freedom. A very important point, and often kind of really misunderstood by people who have very little spiritual insight. They don't understand that actually it is a very positive thing to live your life in a good way. Praised by the wise, right? This is also nice. It's nice to be praised by the wise people. It doesn't really matter so much if all the scallywags of the world praise you. You don't need to worry about that. Oh no, the mafia doesn't praise me for being good, you're not going to think like that. You don't care about what the mafia says, just leave those to one side. So, but the Buddha would praise you, right? That's pretty good. The Buddha said that you're living well, whoa. And then that really feels good. Ungrasped, well this is the ungrasping of the noble ones. For people who are not noble, some grasping is sometimes required. That's okay. It's only if you become a stream maker, these things become natural. That's why it's called ungrasped, because it becomes a natural inclination of your mind for the stream maker. For other ordinary people, it is not always going to be natural, so a little bit of grasping is okay. Remember that you have to have attachments anyway, there's no choice about that, so just make sure you attach in the right place. A little bit of attachment to virtue is good. Leading to stillness, right? Leading to samadhi is the other important point here. This is just what we have seen before, how that virtue gradually leads all the way to samadhi. So then it says, when that noble disciple, when you recollect your own noble character, on that occasion. Your mind is not obsessed by the three defilements. Should really be, this is not, I don't like this translation, should really be not obsessed by desire, not obsessed by ill will, and not obsessed by confusion. Delusion is not so bad, but confusion perhaps even better. Desire, ill will, and confusion, you're not obsessed by those things. Why? And the reason is because you're focusing on something that is purely spiritual. Virtuous behavior is purely spiritual feeling. And all of those other things, when you focus on that and the beauty of that, those other things fall by the wayside. They are no longer, you're no longer interested in that sort of stuff. And that's why that happens. And then your mind is straight based on virtuous behavior, right? Uju, straight in the sense that you're not really so deluded anymore. You start to see things clearly. When the defilements die down, you get this straightness of the mind, a brightness based on that virtue. And then, because of that straightness of the mind, it means that you're already seeing things a little bit in accordance with reality, right? You start to understand what is important in this world. You start to understand why the Buddha's teachings is pointing you in the right direction. And because of that, that's why you gain inspiration in the meaning. This is the Atta Veda. Veda is this beautiful word that is here translated as inspiration. But this word really means a mixture of feeling, right? You feel Veda is also related to Vedana. It's a mixture of feeling and understanding. Understanding and feeling come together in this word Veda. Right? So when you understand that something is beautiful and you feel that it is beautiful and good at the same time, right? That is what Veda is. That's why it's called inspiration here, right? If you feel really inspired by somebody, that is a mix, also a mixture of understanding and feeling, right? That's what inspiration is very often. So here, you feel this inspiration. Atta. Atta means, it does mean meaning, but it also means goal, right? In other words, you can start to see where this is leading, where this is going. You can start to set this goal of Buddhism is very powerful, very beautiful, very worthwhile, that it connects with the meaning of life. And of course, once you start to see that, you become incredibly inspired. You realize that you have found the thing that you have always been looking for. This is what life is really about. Right, that's what you're seeing. Of course you get inspired then. Whoa, this is it. Atta Veda, that's what it means. And from that, you also have the Dhamma Veda, which is the other one, inspiration in the Dhamma. Because you understand that the Buddhist teachings, they are pointing towards this goal. They're pointing towards this aim and purpose, right? Whereby you find all these things that fulfill, as I said, the very meaning of life for you. So that makes you very interested in the suttas, right? When you see that, you think, whoa, I've got to read the suttas more. That's one of maybe one of the consequences of that. I remember Ajahn Brahm told me many years ago, he said to me that, when you read all of these various teachers in the world, because it's very common for people to read all the kind of Buddhist teachers, right, whether they are from the Thai forest tradition or whether they are, you know, Sri Lankan masters like Bhaktivinoda or Burmese masters or Tibetan masters or Mahayana masters from Taiwan or wherever it is, right? You read about all these teachers. But Ajahn Brahm said, well, one, it came clear to me, right, that all of these masters, they're often so idiosyncratic. It's often very hard to really understand what they're talking about and how to relate it to the Dhamma. And he said, from then on, he never really read those teachings of all these masters and teachers anymore. He only focused from that point on the word of the Buddha. Why? Because it is the purest expression there is of this thing we call awakening, of this thing we call understanding things according to reality. The purest expression of that. If you really want to understand Dhamma, that is where you really need to go in the end. Right? So all of the things I'm saying here on this retreat, it might be complete nonsense, except for the stuff that I'm reading out. Right? That is the real thing. So focus on that. Okay. So you get inspiration in that Dhamma, these beautiful teachings that lie behind there, and kind of you understand that the Buddha really understood, and for that reason the Dhamma becomes so powerful. And then you gain joy connected with that Dhamma, right? inspiration and the joy comes, and then this whole sequence arises, just like we said before, taking you all the way to samadhi. Right, so this is how it works. This is how recollection of the virtuous behavior works. And remember again, don't try too hard to recall your virtuous behavior. If you try too hard and force your mind onto kind of thinking about things, it's not going to work very well. It has to be a very soft and gentle approach, saying to yourself, okay, let me think, let me just allow my mind to go into the past and think about something that was very nice, when I felt really good about something. And it has to be almost automatic like that. If you put too much pressure on your mind, you're going to destroy the whole feeling by crushing it to pieces. So it has to be natural. And then you bring, once you remember something nice, you bring that into the present moment, right? And you feel happy about that. So this is the way, or you just happen to have done so much good recently that you just feel naturally glad about yourself. That's even better, even easier. So this is how it works, and then this whole thing arises as a consequence. And then you feel in balance amid an unbalanced population, right? Your mind is in balance. You don't feel like you're being pulled around by desires and aversions all the time. You feel you're flowing through society, just watching all these other people who are struggling away, right? Whereas you are kind of more detached, more moving through things without being pulled around in the same way. It's very beautiful when sometimes you get this feeling we're just flowing along. Okay, the rest of the world may be crazy, but at least you have some degree of evenness in your life, right? Very, very nice. You dwell unafflicted. You don't. The main afflictions in life are things like ill will and desires, right? And now you're leaving those things behind. So a large part of suffering has already been gotten rid of. And again, very beautiful when you kind of get come to that stage. So that is how this recollection of virtuous behavior happens. This is again for the noble disciple. We can only hope to approach that. We can never gain it to exactly the same degree, but at least you can tap into some of that. The more, the better you practice the sila and all of these things. So there you are. That is how meditation ideally happens. So again, just the focus on happiness is very significant, and that gives you some ideas about how important it is to find that ease of the body, that relaxation, so you can actually move in the right direction. Okay, so that is just 11 o'clock. Wow, that's amazing. let's stop there, and let's have a nice lunch everyone together, and then we'll see you again at 3 o'clock. First of all, let's pay our respectful people down there.